This message was produced by Arise, an evangelism, discipleship, and training ministry. For other resources like this, visit us online at arisehub.org.
Before I start my timer, I would just like to begin with a few thank yous. First and most, perhaps most importantly, is I'd like to thank Nathan Renner for his attendance tonight. I've only had the privilege of interacting with Nathan for maybe just perhaps a month or so, but in the month that I've had my interactions with him, I have found him to be incredibly charismatic, very intelligent, insightful, and very kind. And I truly believe that our community is truly blessed to have him here with us and doing his work. So thank you very much for your time. I would also like to thank the audience. Thank you for coming out, particularly in the extreme weather that we're experiencing, perhaps for the next hour, but I've been told by Noah that it should subside within an hour or so, so it shouldn't be too extreme when we leave. Thank you very much for coming out and helping celebrate the spirit of debate. And in addition, thank you very much for coming out and supporting the debate team. And we're very proud every single weekend when we go out and travel around California to represent both our campus, but most importantly, our community. So thank you. And I'd also like to take some time and thank my administration. Dr. Jones personally took me, really walked me around campus, almost hand in hand, taking me to various different offices around campus to really kind of inform me of how to promote tonight's event. And I'd also like to take some time and thank my dean, Michael Torok, for taking the time to help me in order to obtain things that, as a faculty member, were beyond my reach. So thank you very, very much, whoever he is. So as I've started my timer, I wanted to begin tonight by, in a sense, explaining how the origin of tonight's event began with my meeting with Nathan. As I stated, about a month ago, Nathan called me out of the blue and told me that a mutual friend of ours had spoken with him about some ideas that I had discussed with the congregation member, just kind of outside in our community. We decided to meet. Nathan kind of said that he'd heard about some of the ideas of God that I've been facilitating discussions about in an intro to philosophy class that I teach. And we met and we, in a sense, talked about how we could bring the discussions that we were having at the coffee shop here on campus. And initially, the original idea was to invite him to the philosophy class to do a lecture. And then we started, in a sense, starting to think, well, how can we, go bigger and bigger? And that brought us to tonight's event. Because Nathan has a challenge tonight. I mean, I would say Nathan actually has a Herculean task, because Nathan and I, like yourself, inherit a philosophical quandary of sorts, a philosophical quandary that's been occurring for generations and generations, and to be honest, I'm not really quite sure it'll be settled tonight. And I think there was this moment in time where, at some point, human consciousness, at that first moment, they conceived of a God. And I like to believe at some point after that, that person who conceived of a God stubbed their toe. And as a result, from those two experiences, putting those together, they asked the question of why is it that God allows suffering? Now, for Nathan tonight, as I stated, it's a very difficult task, but this issue has not been resolved in introductory philosophy or, I'd say, in the field of philosophy. So if Nathan, in his next speech, uses traditional argumentations that theologists and philosophers have been using to respond to this issue of God and suffering, then unfortunately, Nathan's position, while sounding very comforting, unfortunately be full of contradictions, could potentially be incoherent, and actually has the potential to undermine the very argumentation that proves the existence of God. But before I get to my own contentions I'd like to offer in support of the resolution tonight, I'd like to offer a few observations. The first observation comes from, really, the Intro to Philosophy textbook that I use in my class, and the author makes this kind of summary in which he makes the argument that in literature concerning God, God has three characteristics that are often discussed within philosophy. One is that God is all-powerful. Two, God is all-knowing. And finally, the third, that God is all good. The second observation I'd like to make is that I think it's important for you to know that I'm not here to persuade you. One, I don't think there's anything that I can say that somehow is going to make you completely change your worldview. But instead, I believe that my role tonight is to offer the best arguments I can to support the resolution tonight for this intellectual exercise. And the argumentation that I'm offering tonight is rooted in my experience as a philosopher, as a debater, but perhaps most importantly, as an educator. So I believe that I'm required to present the most honest and ethical arguments I can in order to, in a sense, serve truth, reason, and positive social change. I will not be arguing tonight that God does not exist, nor will I attempt to undermine ideas of faith or prayer. But instead, I will be arguing that these particular idea sets that we're going to be discussing tonight, when you put them in some sort of giant, I don't know, like philosophical shifter and shake them out, what you will find by the end of tonight's activity is that the affirmative side in today's resolution is much more stable. It's much more coherent. And it's that stability, it's that coherency that serves as the most solid foundation that we as a community can have if we hope to reach positive social change. So, I ask that these arguments tonight are evaluated simply within the context of tonight's intellectual fisticuffs. The criteria that I would like to offer tonight is that of community. Community, in a sense, I'm defining as involving those who are local, but still are perhaps the furthest from you in regards to identity. Now, a criteria in regards to the game of debate is a way for an audience to evaluate arguments. You might be hearing dozens, if not hundreds, of different types of arguments tonight. And so what a criteria attempts to do is offer you a guide in regards to what kind of arguments are perhaps the most important, which ones are the ones that you should evaluate first, and in a sense offer perhaps a motivation from which I'm speaking from. My case is comprised of three contentions. Each contention acts as a separate justification to support the resolution. And each contention, if proven valid by the end of today's debate, serves as a separate reason why you should vote for the affirmative today in today's game. So with that in mind, contention number one. God allows suffering. And this is, in a sense, is just really a summary of the classical arguments that can be found in Introduction to Philosophy classes. And it goes to something a little bit like this. First is God is all-powerful. I mean, by definition, the concept of God somehow implies an entity that has the power to change this environment almost as if, really, how it sees fit. And I just want to kind of apologize tonight. I might slip and use the word he to refer to God. And I think, in a sense, that's just a result of my cultural upbringing. I don't intend to offend or pinpoint any particular religion, but that's just, in a sense, how I'm going to talk about it, I think. The second point here underneath this first contention is that the existence of suffering is within God's power to control, decrease, or increase, right? I mean, if we have this idea that God is all-powerful and can do whatever it is that God wants to do, it makes sense that the notion of suffering or pain falls within that realm of power. The third subpoint underneath this contention is that suffering exists. And I don't think I have to do a lot of work here. I mean, we see suffering all the time. We see suffering, whether it be economic suffering, we see spiritual suffering, we see physical suffering. I mean, I think it was just today that Japan was hit with another 7-point-something earthquake and tsunami. Right? I mean, that is a very real example that we see today of very real suffering that, in a sense, undermines Nathan's position tonight. Now, because God is all-powerful and suffering exists, we have to assume, therefore, that God allows suffering. And I don't think that Nathan's going to deny this, but instead, I think what Nathan's going to do is probably respond with traditional argumentation, which will attempt to explain why it is that God allows suffering. So it's not the denial that suffering exists, but instead it's an explanation or justification of why God allows that suffering to perpetuate and occur. And so when we hear Nathan's position, I'd like to simply offer three examples of suffering that Nathan's justification has to somehow explain or respond to by the end of today's debate. The first one is taken from my Intro to Philosophy course, that of the global sex trade. According to estimates, there are 27 million people currently trapped in the global sex trade on the earth. If we draw this to the United States more specifically, per year, it's estimated that 300,000 children under the age of 14 are forced to prostitute their bodies at some point during any particular year. In fact, local media outlets last month stated that Sacramento is actually one of the hubs of the United States child sex slave trade. The second example of suffering that I'd like to offer is that of a media story told on February 25th about a woman in the Philippines who's making lunch when suddenly her cell phone has a text on it. And the text says, "Mommy, I got buried." See, this woman had a 21-year-old exchange student, a daughter, who was an exchange student in New Zealand. And her daughter had just been trapped now underneath a giant building that had fallen from an earthquake that had just happened perhaps minutes ago. So this woman has this phone, and she's looking at this phone, unable to call her daughter because the cell phone reception was out. So over the next hour, she just got text after text after text, such as, "Mommy, help me, my hand is trapped. Mommy, help me, I'm dying." And then the final text that she received was, "Mommy, please make it quick." The third example of suffering that I'd like to offer is taken from the Bible itself, the book of Genesis. And it's actually a story that when I was 8 years old and I heard this story, it really, in a sense, frightened me because it's the Great Flood. Now, according to this narrative, God creates this giant kind of massive water to wash away the evils of humanity. And being 8 years old, I reasoned that, well, if God took out villages and towns and spaces of humanity, of course there was evil, right? Doers in that village or town. But there were also children, 8-year-olds like myself, 5-year-olds like my sister. And from what I knew, I mean, I hadn't really made any evil choices that I was aware of. I mean, I hadn't even grown, like, you know, body hair yet, right? I hadn't even, like, I don't know, maybe, like, I hadn't done anything. And so it really kind of made me question that if there were babies during that flood, those babies suffered. Those babies drowned. And if we were to have some giant tidal wave come in here, we would drown, but there would be a moment of, in a sense, panic, pain, and extreme suffering. The second contention I'd like to offer is that important cultural and historical institutions linked to God capitulate suffering. My first point here is that the churches are silent on wars. Currently, we have wars in Afghanistan, Libya, and Iraq. And wars contain past, present, and tomorrow examples of suffering. One example can be seen in the current Iraq war, where the United States currently uses depleted uranium. In fact, it's been estimated that in 2003, 1,000 tons of depleted uranium were left in Baghdad alone during one of the bombing campaigns. Now, depleted uranium is a substance that, once it's in the ground, it causes cancer and toxic poisonous for those who are left generations, generations, generations after the war is over. We also see in war, we see the instances of rape. We see secret interrogation prisons. And we see citizens being held without trial. We also lose our brothers and sisters. In fact, some estimates have stated that over 4,400 servicemen from the United States have been killed in the Iraq conflict alone. Yet sermons do not focus on the issue on the role that we actively play. Instead, individual members must seek out like-minded advocates for peace, and they must mobilize there. The next example I'd like to offer is that the church and medical industry complicate ethics. There are almost 1 million Americans file for medical bankruptcy every single year. Now, it's estimated that $5,000 is all you need in medical bills to become economically bankrupt. Yet the average hospital cost is $26,000 for one visit. So as a result, there are thousands of Americans that are currently who are in medical bankruptcy and their lives are being destroyed. Their marriages are being destroyed. There's violence in their homes. And their children lose whatever resources are left for their own education. The final contention that I have is that by accepting the resolution of True Today leads to a greater sense of humanity. I would make the argument that by rejecting the idea that God is good, that God is just knowing and all-powerful, we still are able to keep reverence, we're still able to keep humility, and we're still able to keep our appreciation for joy. I will be arguing that by accepting the resolution as true, we move to focus more on humanity and more on community as a solving agent. Unfortunately, I'm out of time, but if this is the route that Nathan would like to pursue later on, I'd like to reserve the right to expand upon this particular point in later moments in time in later speech. That being my 12 minutes, I'm now open for cross-examination, points of clarification.
Okay, Dr. Elizondo, just want to make sure I follow your argument. So essentially your argument is God allows suffering. Suffering is real. And that if we get rid of the idea that God is good, then we'll join together and be better people. Is that a correct understanding of your argument?
I'm not really quite sure. I would say that automatically somehow we just become better people.
Okay.
But what happens is you have the potential for change, and here's why. Because suffering no longer becomes this reward to explain this suffering that I have, right? So in a sense, suffering no longer becomes like justifiable, but instead suffering becomes an opportunity for community and humanity to fill the void. We no longer expect or hope that God will save us, but instead we turn to our neighbors or we turn to each other to save ourselves.
So the argument, again, just so I make sure, suffering exists, God must allow it, if God exists,
mm-hmm.
and if there is no God, if there isn't a good God who allows suffering, then we will be more inclined to fix our own problems.
Yes, I think that's a fair summary. I would say that my position is not necessarily, I'm not just trying to advocate that we see God as evil, but instead that we see God as much more complex. That it's not necessarily true that God is all loving. God is loving, God is hateful, God is greedy, God is joyous, God is encompasses, in a sense, everything. I think that explains our world much more coherently than the idea that God is all loving.
Thank you.
Cool.
Well, before I start the timer, I'd like to take a few minutes to thank Dr. Elizondo for his friendship and for the opportunity to be a part of this forum and to be a part of the life of the community here at Columbia College. In addition, I also would like to extend my thanks to Dr. Jones and Dr. Torok for their support of this endeavor. I think this is really a redemptive activity, debate is, because debate is an opportunity for individuals to wrestle through difficult issues, and I'm just appreciative for the opportunity. And thank you for being here tonight. I take seriously the opportunity to speak to you and also to just consider that there are likely 200 people here investing their time in the two of us, so we respect that and are grateful for that. It is certainly conceivable, given the woeful state of this world, that a malicious or a capricious deity is at the helm of our world. I grant Dr. Elizondo this possibility. However, I'm persuaded that such a conclusion, though it may appear warranted, is not the only or the best conclusion available. Perhaps surprisingly, I am persuaded that the woeful condition of our world harmonizes profoundly and precisely with a good God, even a great God, even the most conceivably good God. In fact, I will argue that our world is exactly the kind of world a perfectly good, perfectly holy, and perfectly benevolent God would make. This evening, I will present two lines of evidence. Let's begin by looking squarely at the challenge. Epicurus in the 3rd century before Christ asked, "Is God willing to prevent evil but not able? Then he is not omnipotent. Is he able but not willing? Then he is malevolent. Is he both able and willing? Then whence cometh evil? Is he neither able nor willing? Then why call him God?" In order to address this question, we should let the great Scottish philosopher John H. Hick frame the problem. If God is perfectly loving, he must wish to abolish evil. And if he is all-powerful, he must be able to abolish evil. But evil exists. Therefore, God cannot be omnipotent, that is, all-powerful and perfectly loving. However, this argument relies on a faulty understanding of omnipotence. Omnipotence, all-power, comes with certain inherent limitations. If with omnipotence everything were possible, everything, then that would include the impossible, because everything is a universal set, must contain the impossible as well. Gregory Boyd articulates the limitations of omnipotence compellingly. There is no reason to avoid saying that God can't do some things so long as we are clear that this can't is the logical consequence of decisions God has made. A few examples might be in order. Can omnipotence create a triangle that has four sides? No, because the moment it has four sides, it's no longer a triangle. Can omnipotence create a circle with a square edge? No, because the moment it has a square edge, it's no longer a circle. Can omnipotence make 2 plus 2 equal 5? No, because the moment it's 5, it's no longer 2 plus 2. Can omnipotence create a love that is forced? Of course not, because the moment it is forced, it is no longer love. Just as a triangle to be a triangle must have three sides, so love to be love must be freely given. To force love is to annihilate it. Love, definitionally, must be free. Or said another way, true love must give the right to not love. Let me illustrate. Imagine that I pulled out a gun and asked you to stand up. What would you do? Likely you'd stand. What if I asked you to turn around? Again, likely you'd turn around. If I asked you to stand on your head, most of you would at least give it a shot. But what if I took the gun and I pointed it directly at you and I said, "Love me or I'll shoot"? Of course, you couldn't do it. Behavior can be compelled, but love must be freely given. Freedom, however, involves risk, because freedom can be misused. Indeed, as anyone who's ever been romantically involved can attest, freedom is risky business. And yet the risk is worth it. In fact, we often find ourselves at risk because of the promise of reward. C.S. Lewis noted, "If a thing is free to be good, it is also free to be bad. And free will is what made evil possible. Why then did God give them free will? Because free will, though it makes evil possible, is also the only thing that makes possible any love or joy or goodness worth having." Simply put, the only reason God would risk creating a world in which evil is possible is because that is the only world in which love, joy, goodness would be possible. A world with freedom is a world in which evil is possible. It's a risky world, but it's also the only kind of world in which true love and freedom could exist. To summarize this argument, we must ask, is the suffering of our world necessarily inconsistent with a good God? And Dr. Elizondo has a high task himself tonight. He has to demonstrate that suffering necessarily demonstrates that God is not good. At this point, I don't believe he's done that. And in fact, I don't think it's possible. So the question is suffering necessarily inconsistent with a good God? And the answer is definitely no. In fact, I am persuaded that the woeful condition of our world perfectly and profoundly and precisely harmonizes with a good God. Why? Because a good God, a God of love, would necessarily grant his creation freedom. And freedom, though it involves risk, also has rewards. Within this context, the existence of evil and suffering is an evidence of a good God, a God of love who values freedom, who is willing to take the risk for love. Second, the question, is God good, assumes that there is some objective standard of goodness which God must meet in order to be good. However, without God, an objective standard of good does not exist. On this point, there is tremendous agreement between theists and atheists. Jean-Paul Sartre, the French existentialist philosopher, said, "It is very distressing that God does not exist, because all possibility of finding values in a heaven of ideas disappear along with him. There can no longer be an a priori good, since there is no infinite and perfect consciousness to think about it." Don't miss Sartre's point. Without God, there is no transcendent a priori definition of good. And he says, that's distressing. All we're left with is a human working definition of good. And where do we get this definition? The respected evolutionary biologist George C. Williams sees morality as an accidental capacity produced in its boundless stupidity by a biological process. Or again, the late J.L. Mackey, professor of philosophy at Oxford University, said, "It's easy to explain the moral sense as a natural product of biology and social evolution rather than having been implanted by the author of nature." Friedrich Nietzsche, the prolific atheist of the last century who proclaimed the death of God, understood this all too well. "The end of Christianity," wrote Nietzsche, "means the advent of nihilism. Nihilism is defined as the rejection of all religion and moral principles." Nietzsche clearly taught that only the man who is able to live beyond good and evil will acquire mastery in the coming age of nihilism, which is already at the door. Again, there is near universal agreement that without a good God who set up objective standards of goodness, good becomes a creation of evolutionary biology, society, or some combination of the two. One society may have evolved to love their neighbor, and another may have evolved to eat their neighbor. Which do you prefer? If goodness and morality are defined by biology and culture, what are we to do when a culture, such as Nazi Germany, decides that it is a moral imperative to slaughter 6 million Jews? Do we say their good is defined by their culture? Let them enjoy it. Clearly, Sartre was correct. Without a God and objective standards of good, without a God, objective standards of good cease to exist, and this is truly distressing. You see, if the secular rationalist view corresponds to reality, then every star of the universe will one day burn out. The era of light will be over, and all life and memory and consciousness will vanish into nothingness. If true, this option means, of course, that the question, why is there suffering, has to be answered somewhat like this. You can do nothing about suffering, because all suffering means nothing. How could it, when one day the stars will burn out, the universe will collapse upon itself, and all matter, space, and time will disappear with absolutely nothing to show for it? In the light of the futility of the world without a good God, Albert Camus remarked in The Myth of Sisyphus that suicide is the one truly serious philosophical problem. If there is no ultimate purpose, why would we choose to continue to live? If, however, the Christian God exists and his promises are trustworthy, then somehow, beyond the stars, somehow beyond the margins of imagination, there is an answer to the question of suffering, and it goes something like this. There is a greater good, one greater than all that has happened. And though the greater good seems impossible even as a possibility, much less a promise, it is a promise of God. Indeed, every day we choose to live, we confess the truth that God is right. The risks of freedom are worth the reward. Now, all of this begs the question, why does God not end suffering now? Before I answer, let me ask you the question. If there was a stop evil now button, stop suffering now button, would you push it? Before you answer, let me tell you a story. When Alexander Solzhenitsyn returned to his native Russia after long years of exile, he greeted all the people he met on his journey across Russia, including the local bureaucrats who had tyrannized their fellow citizens. Some people objected to this, and he responded, "If only there were evil people somewhere insidiously committing evil deeds, and it were necessary only to separate them from the rest of us and destroy them. But the line dividing good and evil cuts through the heart of every human being, and who is willing to destroy a piece of his heart? Because we all have the line between good and evil running through us, God has not pushed the stop evil now button. If he did, we would all cease to exist. He simply loves us too much to do this. However, within the Christian worldview, God chose to meet the suffering and evil of this world by becoming one of us in the person of Jesus. He experienced evil and suffering at every level, from political, social, cultural, personal, and he began to redeem it through his ministry and his death on the cross. His desire is to forgive us for the misuse of our freedom, and that the goodness and love of God would motivate us to build community through our freedom in acts of selfless love for others.
Definitely, I mean, yeah, that was nice. Okay, so just
Just to make sure that I make sense of your position, a good God creates a world of self-determination and freedom.
Correct.
The choice is pivotal to the existence and justification of good. The choice is pivotal to the existence of good and evil. Is that right?
Correct.
Let's see. Choice is the means by which one accesses evil and suffering.
Correct.
Choice is central to the worldview.
Correct.
Okay. So I have here two envelopes, one with an X and one with an O. This is Ashley. She's just sitting in the front row. And for for the purpose, she has to pick an envelope.
Okay.
Which one would now? In one envelope is a $5 gift card to Deo, and in the other envelope is, I think, like an old gum wrapper of mine, right? So one's like kind of reward and one is a punishment. Ashley, which would you like to choose?
X.
X? Okay. So did she just make a choice then?
Yes.
Okay. But she doesn't know the outcome yet.
Correct.
So how do we measure the choice or without knowing the outcome? Aren't they two separate moments in time?
I understand the question. The assumption is that a moral sense has been implanted in each of us, and that as a result of our choice, we unleash a torrent of moral consequences.
Okay. Or the moral consequences.
Certainly.
Okay. I guess my next question would be, in a sense, I understand this issue of choice, right? Uh-huh. But I have a sense I can choose one of the two envelopes,
yes,
and then whatever happens, happens. But how do we apply that to the context of a 7-year-old girl who is being prostituted by her father so that her father can have marijuana money? Like, when does she get to choose?
Okay. So let's ask the other question. Let's ask it in another way. If a father actually loves his child, he has to, in order for that to be authentic love, that love has to be free. Tim, your wife is a social worker. She deals all the time with people who have to take care of their children, even though they're completely unfit to do so. I'm assuming that she deals with people like that anyway. So the question is, if you make people care for their children, can you call that love? If God insisted that everyone behaved in a certain way, I mean, are we really asking, in order for God to be good, that he would regulate, he would force, that he would compel our behavior? Is that the standard? Is force the standard of good in this debate? Is compulsion the standard of good?
Is compulsion the standard of good? I'm not really quite sure that's where I want to get to my process. I guess where
okay.
My process is, when does a 7-year-old girl get to choose between good and evil?
Okay. So the answer is, all of us have a moral sense at some point. Exactly when we develop a moral sense isn't really an issue in this debate, because all of us, in order for a world to operate properly, the laws of cause and effect, in order for love to operate properly, the laws of cause and effect have to be in operation. But that's a two-sided weapon, so to speak. So in the sense, if we expect a child to be able to experience love, that child has to have the freedom to also experience non-love. And so it's a two-sided dilemma, so to speak. And for God, suffering was worth the risk.
Thank you for your time. I kind of would like to begin with two points that might become major issues as we proceed through this debate. The first is that Nathan's argumentation is very pivotal on the idea of cause and effect, right? It forces us to somehow have this choice, have consequences, and then measure out the meaning or the implications of that choice in retrospection. So just want to kind of throw that out there. The second is that I believe that Nathan's, in a sense, is setting up this really kind of problematic of this idea of possible versus impossible. He states that there are restrictions on the power, the influence that God has. But I'm not really quite sure how that's coherent with the idea of God, because in a sense, if God can do whatever God wants to in this environment, right, then God doesn't necessarily have limits. Another kind of point I'd like to make is I also believe that some of the argumentation is based upon kind of language slippage, right? That a triangle by definition has three sides. I mean, that's why we call it a triangle. A shape that doesn't have any sides at all, we call it a circle. But if you took a landmass of a circle, you could, in a sense, take that landmass and turn it into some sort of square plot. So simply because a triangle by definition has three sides, or love by definition implies choice, I'm still really unclear of how that necessarily proves the existence of God, because the term triangle, circle, and love are human-made terms from language. In specific response to his points, the first about that somehow that the notion of goodness needs God, I have three responses. The first is that his statement that without God, universal standards of good and bad are lost, I would say, first, that's not true. There are universal standards that exist outside of the belief in God. I would say that one value that we see across cultures, regardless of how they define their deities, is the love and care for their children. I mean, I would say that is a universal value. Second is, I would say I know lots of people that don't believe in God, whether they be atheists or secular or humanists or however they define themselves, that consistently would say that somehow there's this shared value or this shared love that they feel for other human beings. But second is that God can still exist without the existence of universal good or bad, especially if we acknowledge that good and bad requires human introspection. Right? God transcends that binary of good and bad. Right? Originally, I'm saying that God encompasses everything. And one example of a concept that transcends that binary of good and bad is death. I mean, in a sense, God, death is something that we imply lots of different values or lots of different meanings to, right? It's, in a sense, it transcends. Third is that even if there are universal standards, I would argue that we as human beings don't have access to those universal standards. Right, that if universal standards exist in this kind of like platonic plane with God, that we as human beings, we're here. Right? We can only guess or speculate or discuss what those universal values are, but we're never going to get confirmation, at least in this plane of existence. Up against his point about nihilism, you know, this idea that somehow like nihilism facilitates this idea that Mike makes right, I think is a little bit of a stretch. And we can point to Kierkegaard, who states that the distinction means that God does not necessarily create human morality, but instead it's up to the individual to create our own morality for ourselves. And that truly religious people, in this view, will be prepared that if God does come down, that divine creed or that divine command will take precedence over the morality that human beings have facilitated among themselves. Third, this notion that the possible is also impossible and some's possible, it's not possible, that he brings to the very end of his speech, I think in a sense is a contradiction from his earlier claim that God can do or cannot do certain things. Right? So first he makes the argument that, well, there's this kind of this limitation of power, and then in a sense he reverses that at the end of the speech. And finally at this point, I'll just skip that. Okay, this notion of choice is kind of something that I want to get into, because I wanted it to really highlight this idea that there are two moments in time that Nathan's position conflates together. The first is that there's the moment of choice, and then there's the moment of consequence, right? Schrodinger's cat, I think, is one example of this, right, where you have maybe two boxes, and in one box there's a dead cat, but you don't know which box it's in, and you have to choose, right? So you choose, and then you walk up, you open the box, and then you find out the income or the outcome. It's really, for a real world example, it's if you're in a bar and you see that special someone and you muster up the courage to go walk over to that someone, that's the choice. But it's the outcome, which is rather it's the first date, or maybe it's the drink in the face, or maybe it's the meaningful conversation, or maybe it's the marriage, that is the consequence. And they are two separate moments. I would make the argument that I think it's very philosophically possible To have a world where God still allows you to choose between good and evil, but not have that choice lead to the suffering of others. It makes sense that when we choose evil, that evil things happen to us. But I'm still not convinced that Nathan's worldview explains why my choice to make this small little girl suffer, right, somehow justifies, because this little girl never was given the choice to choose. She lives in perpetual state of not having freedom. She lives in a perpetual state of not having choice. She lives in a perpetual state of not having love, which by very definition is the godliness that Nathan speaks of. So this little girl never has the access to feel or love God in her plane. And I think one example where I can perhaps point to that demonstrates how we can have this type of philosophical paradigm is Wile E. Coyote versus Roadrunner cartoons. Right? In this, for those who aren't familiar with it, Wile E. Coyote is constantly always trying to chase the Roadrunner and capture the Roadrunner. And he comes up with these really like bizarre contraptions, right? Catapults that fire boulders and tiger traps and like rockets from the Acme company. But every single time the Roadrunner is unscathed. Every single episode, the coyote chooses evil, and it's the coyote that suffers, not the Roadrunner. And you might think, well, okay, well, this is just one example, but this was 55 episodes, and I would say that that's enough to establish perhaps a pattern that Chuck Jones was showing us another possible world. And we see this every single day in our own lives, right? We see examples of tornadoes that blow through hometowns in Kansas and leave that one house. We see stories of floods that wipe away, you know, dozens of people but leave that one small child. Right? People are, in a sense, are saved from disaster every single day in ways that we can't explain. So we see miracles. We know that God causes some suffering while sparing others some suffering. We pray to unsuffering. And I would say that our prayers and the things that we witness, these cultural practices, these cosmological experiences, point to a worldview that tells us that an all-powerful God stops some suffering. In one conversation I had with Nathan once, he described the God that I'm describing as a megalomaniac. And perhaps it's true. My worldview does suppose that God is a gangster. It supposes that God is perhaps preoccupied with unlimited power, and that he's preoccupied with unlimited achievements, extravagant actions, and the flattery of others. Bertrand Russell once stated that the interpretation of a megalomaniac is that he differs from a narcissist by the fact that he wishes to be powerful rather than charming and seeks to be feared rather than loved. Nathan identifies this kind of God, but he does not explain why this kind of God is less desirable or why this kind of God is not possible. I would argue that this kind of God is preferable. Because by affirming the resolution tonight, we reject the status quo as a justification of suffering. This idea that right now is the best possible world we could possibly have immediately accepts, what was it, the 300,000 children every single year that are trapped in the United States sex trade. And I believe that kind of perspective is unjust and unreasonable and should not be affirmed in tonight's debate. Thank you.
I grant, Dr. Elizondo, can you start your timer? Because I think yours works better than mine.
Sure.
Thank you. Mine stopped. I couldn't see it, so I want to make sure I didn't go over. I grant Dr. Elizondo's first contention, which is God allows suffering. But we've already answered why God allows suffering. In some sense, he has to. God can't do that which is definitionally impossible. He cannot create square circles. And I don't think that's just language gymnastics. God cannot do what's definitionally impossible. He cannot force love. Love requires freedom, and freedom involves risk. Yes, the choice does precede the effect, and yet that is the reality of the world as God has structured it. Love requires freedom. Freedom entails risk. And risk entails responsibility, and responsibility makes for morality. Dr. Elizondo contended that somehow predictability negates freedom. Predictability does not negate freedom. Predictability is just that. I can know ahead of time what happens, and that doesn't impact the person's choice. Contention number two, he said, an explanation as to why God allows suffering must respond to actual examples of suffering. I have demonstrated that freedom is a sufficient answer for the suffering of our world. Interestingly, though, Dr. Elizondo brought out three specific kinds of suffering. The first is the result of evil human actions, the sex trade. The second is the suffering as a result of natural disasters. He mentioned earthquakes. And the third is the suffering as a result of supernatural disasters like Noah's flood. Let's begin with the suffering as a result of evil human actions. In a world with freedom, in which love is real and can have an actual impact on another person, the laws of cause and effect must be in operation, which can function for good and for evil. C.S. Lewis once noted, "We can perhaps conceive of a world in which God corrected the results of the abuse of free will by his creatures at every moment, so that a wooden beam becomes soft as grass when used as a weapon, and the air refused to obey me if I attempted to set up in it the sound wave that would carry lies or insults. But such a world would be one in which wrong decisions were impossible, and in which, therefore, freedom of the will would be void. That God can and does, on occasion, modify the behavior of matter and produce what we call miracles is part of the Christian faith. But the very conception of a common and therefore stable world demands that these occasions should be extremely rare. In a game of chess, you can make certain arbitrary concessions to your opponent, which stand to the ordinary rules of the game, as miracles stand to the laws of nature. You can deprive yourself of a castle, or allow the other man sometimes to take back a move made inadvertently. But if you concede everything that at any moment happened to suit him, if all of his moves were revocable, and if all your pieces disappeared whenever their position on the board was not to your liking, then you could not have a game at all. And Wile E. Coyote eliminates the ability for authentic relationship and authentic love, and that is what matters most to a God of love. So it is with the life of all souls in the world. Fixed laws, consequences, unfolding by causal necessity, the whole natural order are at once limits within which their common life is confined, and also the sole condition under which any such life is possible. Try to exclude the possibility of suffering which the order of nature and existence of free will involve, and you will find you have excluded life itself. There is a reason why Wile E. Coyote is a cartoon. It should be obvious that it does not operate in the realm of cause and effect, which is necessary for authentic love and relationship. The second that Dr. Elizondo brings out is suffering that is a result of natural disasters. Within the Christian perspective, human sin impacted not just humanity, but all the earth. In the last 100 years, we have become intimately acquainted with the impact of human sin on the biosphere. Fracking is poisoning our wells and causing earthquakes across America. Radiation is spewing from Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant. Thousands are struck with cancer in Australia and New Zealand each year as a result of the hole in the ozone layer, not to mention the potentially cascading effects of global warming. Obviously, the actions of humanity are intimately connected with the health of our planet. Indeed, the biblical book of Leviticus spoke accurately when it warned Israel to keep God's commandments so that the land does not vomit you out when you make it unclean, as it had vomited out the other nations before you. The relationship between the natural world and human action is not always clear. However, the new field of chaos theory has explanatory power in this domain. The classic example of chaos theory is the butterflies that fly away in Africa that cause a hurricane in Florida. The earth and the actions of humanity and human and animal life are connected in ways that we are only beginning to understand. And it should be clear that the abuse of human freedom, and Christians stand against the abuse of human freedom that has led to the degradation of the environment. And on that, Dr. Elizondo and I agree, as a community, we certainly should fight against that. Suffering is a result of supernatural disasters. Let's start with a question. Are we upset because God doesn't intervene to stop the sex trade, but he does intervene to stop a world filled with violence in Noah's day? Can we have it both ways? If we accept the flood narrative as true, then we must be willing to accept its interpretation of the human condition. If God has unlimited knowledge, then his assessment of human condition is perfectly accurate. Genesis describes humanity as only evil continually and filled with violence. Dr. Elizondo protests that babies died. But what's the alternative? Let the babies live with evil, abusive, violent parents? Or perhaps let Noah and his family raise the sum total of the world's babies? If the God of the Bible is the God of the resurrection, if babies die to be saved from violent, evil, abusive parents only to be resurrected to live in a place with no suffering, I doubt they'll be complaining. Now, on the issue of important historical and cultural institutions that capitulate suffering, I fail to see how this argument advances the resolution. It may advance the resolution, the church is not good. It may advance the resolution, the hospital isn't good. But what bad decisions people make is not reflective of God. Finally, his contention that accepting the resolution as true leads to a greater sense of humanity is not a necessary result of accepting the resolution. And he has already admitted that. In fact, societies that have accepted the resolution, the results have been very different than Dr. Elizondo predicted. For instance, the way Darwinian evolution and the post-Darwinian theory of eugenics conspired together to help create the intellectual climate that made the Holocaust possible. Additionally, Marx and his atheistic philosophy conspired to produce Stalin's communism, which didn't mitigate poverty or increase wealth for the working class, and yet led to the slaughter of 20 million people. In fact, neighbors and communities, he suggests that neighbors could join together to solve the problems. This is demonstrably false. Studies have demonstrated that the least charitable people in America are secular conservatives, followed by secular liberals. Yeah, go ahead, knock away on that. The most charitable people in America with their time and money are liberal and conservative religious people. So what would cause a secular vision, a vision without a good God, to change the way secular people behave so badly in this regard currently? Tonight I contend that love, freedom, and risk provide the best explanation for the suffering in the world. So what do we want to do?
Got some cross X.
Is there cross X after this? Did I neglect to...
No, it's from the audience.
Oh, from the audience. Mm-hmm. Okay, that makes sense. I didn't want any more from you.
All right, if you just want to raise your hand, I'll come to your aisle and you can ask your question. Just go ahead and save your questions for us.
Doctor, do you believe that individual free choice is possible in the world if everyone was good?
Do I believe that there is free choice in a world where everyone is good? I think what I'm advocating tonight is in a sense kind of a rejection of that notion of good. That in a sense that we can come up with some sort of objective, kind of universal way of measuring out so that we know what is good versus what is bad, particularly in light of a worldview that asks us to experience badness in order to understand goodness. It just seems as if it's much more seamless than that. And again, I would actually probably just reject the idea of good and bad. Would you like to respond?
Sure. A world without the possibility of bad is a world that is not possible, at least right now. I think a world without the possibility of suffering and evil is a world without a possibility of love.
This is directed at Nathan.
Okay.
Right here.
Can
you
Yep.
You seem to keep dropping the fact that the little girl has suffered at the hands of others. But is getting raped. How do you explain that little girl, when she is getting raped, where is God? Why isn't he protecting her? What is your answer to that, little girl?
You know, it's a great question. And, you know, it's something that I didn't take the time to talk about the human dimension of how God relates to evil. In some sense, there's no answer. I can't say, you know, God was right there with you, although I believe that's true. I can't say, in response to the question, if somebody came to me, so my office as a pastor, and said, this is what I've gone through, what I would do is I would say to them, I'm so sorry. You know, Dr. Elizondo brings out, and this is the answer to the question. Dr. Elizondo brings out that maybe God is good and bad. And in that sense, I actually agree with a portion of what he's suggesting. And that is, the world appears as if God is good and bad because this world is at war. The reason the world looks like a war zone is because it is a war zone. There is a battle between two spiritual forces. And what I would say to a person who is in a horrible position of suffering, I would say to that person, the reason that the world and your life feels like a war zone is because it is, but love wins. The only question is the war between God and God? Or God and an adversary.
I would say that my response to Nathan's remarks is that I believe that when you look at the world, if you truly believe that the world looks like a war zone, that perhaps it's rooted in the idea that our God is good and their God is not good. If you look at the rhetoric of our political leaders, right, who God is actually into the war, that is the very rhetoric that they have used to perpetuate the war zone that we see around us.
This is directed to the pastor. My question would be, you said earlier that there is no possibility of this world not having any bad in it. And yet, to my understanding, the reward of following God's teachings is a place called heaven.
Yeah.
And so why can't we have heaven on earth?
That's a great question. And I'm going to answer that in my closing argument. But essentially, it's this. When we get to heaven, heaven will be a place where everyone has freely chosen to yield their will to God. Essentially, that's the goal. And so the reason that we can't have heaven here is because all of us, myself included, choose to abuse our free will. But the time will come, and I hope soon, where we will have given ourselves and our wills to God, and then we will be safe to take to heaven.
I sense, really, I'm struck by how Nathan's response, there's nothing in my advocacy tonight that forces me to contradict or clash with his articulation. You could actually have exactly what Nathan articulated and still accept the idea that God is not all good. Right, that God perhaps gives us suffering or gives us choices as a divine test to see if humanity can survive. Right? Just as if we don't notice the ants underneath our feet, right, as we perhaps walk to the very forum tonight, right, that God is preoccupied with other things in the universe and that we can still have heaven. We can still see this material plane as a place where we wrestle with those very issues and still affirm the resolution tonight. And that is my central advocacy, is that you can still have a God while accepting the idea that God is much more complicated than being 100% all good.
If we believe in a God who is both a God of good and evil, or if we believe in no God and we came from the evolutionary process, how do we know the difference between good and evil? How did that arise?
To whom is the question directed?
Either. Oh.
Well, we
we need somebody to start. Who would you like to begin?
I'd like you to begin.
Okay, could you rephrase the question just so I can...
How do we know what is good and evil? Why is it bad to abuse a child? How do we know? Where did it come from if it came from animals and monkeys and whatnot?
See, I think that's what's really nice about the advocacy that I... The fortunate position I'm in tonight, because I don't know if I have to have... I don't have to explain what is good or what is evil or why that's measured. That's, in a sense, that's his burden, because he's bringing forth that foundation to explain suffering. And I would say that his perspective forces us to measure goodness based on a very Eurocentric perspective, where if we like the outcome, right, if somehow, like, I'm rewarded today from some 2 years of experience, then that 2 years of experience is somehow good. Right. And so I think, in a sense, it forces us to look at life and perhaps to even look at our own spirituality in very economic terms. Right. It becomes very possible. Then we start having to ask the question, well, how much do I have to suffer before I can reach goodness? Like, how much suffering equals this much goodness? And I think that's where the incoherency comes in.
The question is a phenomenal question. Without God, objective moral values do not exist. It's just that simple. And there is tremendous agreement on that point across the intellectual spectrum. There is no question in Jean-Paul Sartre's mind whether or not objective moral values exist. He says God doesn't exist, objective moral values don't exist. J.L. Mackey, objective moral values do not exist. Without God, objective moral values do not exist. And therefore, your us whining about suffering is groundless. Suffering just is without God. And if you suffer, who cares? Really? Now, Dr. Elizondo would like to tell us that, well, we should care because it's good for the community. But what my contention is there is no ontological basis for that care. There may be an existential basis to care. There may be an experiential basis to care. But there is no ontological basis to care. Without God, suffering just is. And get over it, because the whole universe is going to melt down and we're all going to die.
This is directed to Nathan. You guys have made this issue of suffering a matter of choice. I think that's interesting. I'm going to come back to that. You've also not defined the word good, and we're having a great debate on good or bad, but you haven't defined either term. I want to go back to my first point, which is the issue of choice. When a guy is throwing the baseball and the lightning strikes that little kid and it kills him, it is not a matter of choice. Choice isn't even in the issue. When you have suffering in the world that is not a result of choice at all, like the tsunami, it just simply is. I don't think you guys have addressed that issue, because that issue then says God is essentially evil, because if he gave a rip, if he gave a concern at all, he would have prevented the lightning from striking the boy, or if he exists at all, he would have done something. For not to do anything at all. So I just think it's interesting the way you reframe the whole issue of evil, the problem of evil, to choice. Well, we all know that it's not always a function of choice at all. And that's why we raised the issue in the first place.
Is it my turn to go first?
I didn't hear a question. Did you have a question?
I think the question I heard, maybe I'm just reading into it, was, what about suffering that's a result of non-choice, being struck by lightning? The answer I gave, and maybe I didn't give it as clear as I should have, ultimately, as a Christian, I operate within a Christian worldview. I believe that our first parents made a bad choice that impacted the way the entire globe operates. Does that make sense? I mean, you know, I'm not asking you to agree with it. Does that make sense? Our first parents made a choice that impacted how the whole globe operates. I also made a choice. For instance, I drive a car. That causes global warming. That impacts the planet. In other words, I don't think that there's a necessarily a direct cause and effect line between all suffering and all choice. But I do believe that our choices set in motion a war. And in that war, people are hurt. And God, his heart breaks, and I think ours should break. And as Dr. Elizondo has contended again and again, we should seek to alleviate that suffering as much as we can.
I think if I was trying to capture the definition of good, I might turn to the work of philosopher Michel Foucault, who offers the kind of academia this idea of discourse. And if we think about it, applying it to the notion of good, in a sense, good is a very subjective term that changes over time. I think in a sense, it's one of the reasons why Nathan has not defined it. Because as soon as you define it, it becomes very slippery, right? It's very kind of hard to capture. We know of certain pills, for example, that 10 years ago were good, and now not so much, right? Or other kind of medical treatments. We know there are individuals in the world that used to be good individuals, good leaders of their countries, and now we have kind of, in retrospect, maybe they weren't so good, right? So good is something that changes over time. Other than the notion of parents being the one universal standard that I've offered that Nathan has not contradicted or refuted tonight, I would say that other types of standards based in religious thought about morality are very fluid and very subject to change. So vote AF.
Behind you, there's...
I'll go back out.
All right, this one's for Pastor Nathan. If God is so forgiving and so loving, why did he create a hell?
I don't believe in that kind of hell. As a Seventh-day Adventist Christian, I believe that when a person dies, and this is what the Bible teaches, and more scholars are agreeing, when a person dies, they don't go to heaven, they don't go to hell, they go to sleep. That's what we believe. And Scripture teaches that someday God will resurrect everyone, and those who have chosen to be in a relationship with God will be able to live for eternity. And those who have said, you know, God, I'm just not liking the way you roll with things, then God will say, hey, that's okay, you can sleep forever. That's the biblical picture. Now, there's all kinds of hell language, but when you pay careful attention to the language of Scripture, you find that the traditional depictions of hell owe more to Hellenistic worldview, Greek worldview, than the Hebrew worldview of the Bible. So it's a great question.
I think in a sense, if you believe in the concept of hell, it supports the affirmative of the resolution today, right? I mean, this idea that if God has created this space that... Pardon? Oh, I, if God creates this space where human beings are sent to suffer for a particular amount of time, I think it affirms the resolution. So if you do believe in hell, you are voting affirmative for me tonight. So... And if we accept this idea that perhaps that if this is our hell or this is where we, in a sense, we test suffering, I think with my worldview that I'm advocating, suffering doesn't become meaningless, right? But instead, it becomes a moment of divinity. That suffering becomes God talking to us, asking us what we do in that challenge, what we do in that darkness, what we do for each other when faced with that moment of suffering. Do not be convinced by Nathan that simply by, you know, affirming the resolution, we have some sort of like godless, soulless nation or world. But instead, we have a world where suffering brings us together and it ignites that spark of humanity where we look at each other and we become responsible for saving ourselves. Instead of looking at somebody floating away in the tsunami by saying, I hope God saves them, instead we look at them and we say, you know what, maybe I should do something right now to save that person.
I think you just clarified for me in the language that I was trying to find. But for me, believing that God is all good also means that I believe there is an equal and opposite good for all evil. And your statement saying that it moves us from that place of comfortability to action. And having not had that evil in the world, we wouldn't be moved from our places of comfortability. We wouldn't be thinking about people far away, and we wouldn't be thinking about the poor. And I guess my question is to Nathan, does God allow this suffering so that those of us who are stuck in this consciousness that can't move, that extreme suffering finally moves us?
You know, as soon as the hurricane hit in Haiti, a young man from my congregation solicited funds from our church, and he went down there and he worked for a month straight where there was very little food, very little water, seeking to do whatever he could do to serve that community. He just got back a couple of days ago. He spent 2 weeks there training Haitians on how to do rescue operations. Your point is an excellent point, and I think Dr. Elizondo would agree with it completely, that suffering does motivate us. You know, Dr. Elizondo is presenting a caricature of the idea that God is good, maybe not intentionally. The idea that Christians are sort of fat and happy, stuck here in America, enjoying ourselves while the rest of the world suffers. Statistically, a Christian is 30% more likely to give to a secular charity than a secular person. Statistically, a Christian will spend more time volunteering to meet the needs of suffering humanity than a secular person. If Dr. Elizondo is correct that accepting the resolution that God is not good will lead to greater public service, he has one gigantic obstacle to overcome, and that is the facts of history.
I disagree. Because Nathan has not responded to the second example that I offered about hospitals. I mean, currently within the United States, our medical industries are merging with certain religious institutions. And in my contention, I told you that these individuals, people like ourselves who go to these hospitals, are leaving these hospitals bankrupt. Right. That in a sense, these hospitals which support, and in their very mission statements say that they exist to, in a sense, spread the service of Jesus Christ, knowingly perpetuate a system they are crushing individuals in our community. And it is a system that rewards very select individuals. Right. It's a system that those individuals on top making those six-figure salaries that declare themselves to be Christians, they're not stopping the suffering. Right, even though they may have the option to. So I think in a sense this is somewhat empirically denied, particularly if we look at the pay structure of a hospital where the individuals who actually touch the blood and the feces of the most sick in that hospital are those that are the least paid. I want Nathan to be correct. I wish that Nathan was correct, because in a sense Nathan's worldview does give us comfort in hospice. But to make the argument that somehow to just focus on the positive aspects that Christians have done, which is numerous and is very many and it's very glorious, it overlooks that tragedy and suffering that is existing in our very community that we in this room can actually voice out after this debate's been over and immediately attempt to change.
You make a really good point about human beings being the evil part of God's creation. And yet, God loves us enough to give us one good thing, and that's in Jesus Christ. And yet, we don't see that spoke about between both. He destroyed the world with a flood, and yet at the same time, he's good enough to forgive that father for prostituting his daughter. The father, if he repented, can have that eternal life in Jesus Christ, and that makes God good. Yet the child, because of the evil that the father did, doesn't make the child evil. We define what is evil among ourselves just just like you said, society does that. What do you say?
I'm really glad you brought up Jesus Christ, because I think this actually might blow the mind of my wife. I mean, if you really kind of knew the transformation that I've experienced just having conversations with Nathan, I think you'd be pretty boggled at what I'm about to say next. But I would advocate Jesus Christ. And I think in a sense that, because Jesus Christ is somebody that, even if you paint me as an atheist, which I've never articulated an atheist position tonight, intentionally, but even if you paint me as an atheist, there is a historical record that academics agree that Jesus Christ existed. And that Jesus Christ spread around and walked around the world in an attempt to promote positive social change. That dedicated his life to the poor. That dedicated his life to the sick. That had a philosophy that promoted goodness and kindness. And where we can disagree is who Jesus' father was, or the implications of Jesus, or kind of the larger cosmological questions that, to be honest, we can't answer. But we can all agree that Jesus Christ is a person we can point to and perhaps all follow the teachings of him, right? In a way that, in a sense, allows us to, again, affirm the resolution tonight.
I appreciate Dr. Elizondo, and forgive me, certainly, if I painted you as an atheist. That certainly wasn't my intention. When you bring up Jesus, you bring up a sticky situation. And here's the reason why. Jesus was certainly a very good man. Jesus was a man who went about doing good, healing the sick, serving the poor, exactly those kinds of things that we as Christians are called to do, although sometimes we don't succeed as much as we wish we did. However, Jesus made claims to be the Lord of heaven. He is either a liar, a lunatic, or the Lord of heaven. So we could look at him and we could say, Jesus, we appreciate what you've done. We like your service to the community. You've given us a noble example to follow, excepting perhaps the fact that you lied about who you were. I think that it's well for us to not just appreciate Jesus for his good deeds, which were certainly many, and we should appreciate them for those, but we should be willing to investigate his claims. But that's not what this debate is about tonight. And that's really the main reason we haven't focused on it.
All right, I think we have time for one more question.
This is my first time to the debate, so I'm not sure. But good, you say it's God. Why hasn't Satan, the opposite, bad, been introduced? Because to know the difference between good and bad, good God, bad evil.
As I understand it, I'm not going to speak for Tim, although I am. As I understand Tim's argument, the concept that Christians normally equate with Christian, he's sort of rolled up in with Satan. Tim is sort of rolled up into God. God is both good and bad. As a Christian, I would maintain that the world looks like a war zone. The reason the world looks like a war zone is because there's a great controversy. There's a battle between good and evil. And that some of us are rolling our dice on one side or the other. All of us rolled the dice on the wrong side at one time. And the reason the world looks like a war zone is because it is. So in response to your question, I would say I fully acknowledge that reality of the antithesis of good. Call him Satan. And yeah.
That's a really good question. I never really kind of thought about how to kind of frame the devil into my remarks tonight, or Satan. I would probably advocate that the concept of the devil or the concept of Satan is a rhetorical tool used within Christianity to resolve the very philosophical problems that Nathan is confronted with tonight. Sorry, I was trying to make sure to organize it. Is that right? It's 5 minutes is what I have? I think it is. Okay. Before we begin, again, just want to thank Nathan, thank the audience. It's really just been a privilege, and thank you very much for allowing me to take up your time and speak. So, again, thank you very much. The challenge that I set up at the very beginning of this debate is that Nathan's advocacy tonight has to somehow address the three very specific examples of suffering that I advocated at the very beginning of my opening remarks. And my belief is that Nathan has not adequately done that. And as your cross-examination demonstrates, his answers only, in a sense, raise more questions. So in response to his really kind of his more specific remarks, first I'd like to begin with his explanation about choice and freedom and this kind of cause and effect answer that he gives. If you look at his remarks on the flow, his response to one of my examples is that, well, it's cause and effect, right? So here's something and then this is something else. But then in response to my third example, he says, well, there's chaos theory, right? That a butterfly flaps its wings and then you have this hurricane. Chaos theory is a philosophical response to cause and effect, right? Chaos theory tells us that we can't make cause and effect determinations. It is the very antithesis of cause and effect. So when Nathan responds by saying he wants to embrace cause and effect, and then seconds later wants to embrace chaos theory, they're not compatible, right? Because chaos theory tells us that you can never make 100% clear connections between cause and effect. Right? But more specifically against some of his refutation on my points. His first response about this notion of Darwin and eugenics. Well, first of all, I never brought up the idea of Darwin tonight, right? Second, I'm not necessarily saying that I support the idea of eugenics. But third is that I'm not really quite sure that Hitler was specifically influenced by Darwin or by eugenics. Eugenics is a term that is very, very broad. It means lots of different things. There's social eugenics, there's scientific eugenics, right? Hitler used social eugenics, right? But there's many of us in this room who might practice scientific eugenics. If you ever were married and had to perhaps submit some sort of DNA test to see if you and your spouse were compatible to have children, or if you were in favor of some sort of genetic testing in order to prevent children from having certain types of illnesses, that is eugenics. So this idea that somehow eugenics or my position causes these negative things in response to this part of the flow or this part of the debate should not be accepted. Second is that he then goes into this idea that Marx somehow facilitates terribleness. I never brought up Marx, right? Second is that I would say that the argument that somehow that Marx is responsible for Stalin, who's then responsible for the bourgeois, who's then responsible for killing all these people, that's kind of hard to pin Marx responsible for. Right, because Marx wrote those like before he knew what other people how they would interpret his writing. Next, Marx actually believed in God. Right, I mean his parents were Jewish, and then they transferred or then they converted to Christianity. Right, Marx actually said that churches are the heart in a heartless society. But next, I'd say if you're going to say that I'm Marx, right, and then you're going to pin Adam Smith on him, Adam Smith actually in his writing has a term, the hand of God. And I would make the argument that capitalism and the hand of God has caused much more disasters or oppression than anything that the Marx has written, right? Because if you're going to go with the alternative of capitalism, capitalism has caused, capitalism, you could also say that the belief in God is motivating current genocides in Rwanda or Congo, or you could say, in a sense, is facilitating the war in the Middle East. This idea that somehow we can choose goodness and evil, and that God gives us free will, complicates the very idea that God is all-knowing. Because if God is all-knowing, right, God knows the choices you've made in the past, he knows the choices you're making now, and God knows the choices you're going to make tonight and in the future. Right? But in a sense, God already knows what you're going to wear when you go to bed. God already knows what kind of TV show you're going to watch, because God is all-knowing. But if we accept this idea that somehow humans can, when they're presented with this choice, can go in a way that God is like, I don't know what you're going to do, right? That undermines the idea that God is all-knowing, right? So if you really accept this idea of choice, and if that makes sense to you, then what unfortunately, or perhaps fortunately, we might need to have another debate in the fall, because now the resolution is God is not all-knowing. Right? Undermining the very existence of God. Now, I only have 30 minutes left in my speech, so I'm not really quite sure what I can really summarize. So instead, I just kind of want to point out the similarities between the two speakers tonight. I just encourage you to entertain the arguments that have already been made. But what I really appreciate for tonight is that him and I are both advocates. And that, in a sense, I believe that him and I are actually parts of the same apparatus that are trying to, in a sense, speak to our community and promote really particular kinds of values. But I believe that by affirming the resolution tonight, what happens to that apparatus is that you actually allow this space, whether it's education or academia, to have God in it. Because we don't have to explain and go to really specific kind of religious texts to answer the questions that we wrestle with daily. Right? This becomes, our college can become, in a sense, a house of God, just like his house of God is a place where he educates people. But by voting for him tonight, right, against the resolution, in a sense, I would make the argument that that's not necessarily feasible. Because the very questions that we're asking only perpetuate more questions and have no answers. And it's those questions and those answers that ultimately will divide us. So by returning to the criteria tonight of that of community, I would make the argument that if those are the arguments that you're evaluating, it's a clear win for the affirmative in tonight's debate. I thank you very much for your time.
Tonight, Dr. Elizondo reminded us that suffering is real. He critiqued the response of the church to the pain and suffering all around. However, he has failed to demonstrate the resolution, God is not all good, is necessarily true. Furthermore, I have demonstrated that a good God would grant his children freedom, that freedom involves risk. In short, we can summarize my argument by simply saying, love, freedom, risk. Additionally, we discovered that a good God is necessary for an objective standard of goodness to exist. I fear that Dr. Elizondo missed my point in bringing up several examples from Marx, etc. The point is very simple. Without God, objective moral values do not exist. On this point, there's broad agreement across the intellectual spectrum. In fact, we essentially surrender the right to ask if there is meaning in suffering if there is not a good God. As Dr. William Lane Craig summarized, in the absence of God, we're just accidental byproducts of nature which have evolved relatively recently on an infinitesimal speck of dust lost somewhere in a hostile and mindless universe, and which are doomed to perish individually and collectively in relative short time. If a good God does not exist, then suffering just is. And the death of a child is no more significant than the death of an ant or an exploding nebula. Finally, we must ask why God doesn't just put an end to all suffering. Please imagine with me for a moment that your son has just been abducted and murdered by some vicious criminal. What do you feel toward the perpetrator? Are you angry? Yes, and rightly so. Raging would be a better word. Would you call the police? Yes, of course. You might even hunt the murderer down yourself. Would you press charges? Yes, without hesitancy. Testify against the evildoer? Yes. Demand that the full measure of justice be executed against the horrible person who did this? Yes. But now, as you're feeling all of those justifiable emotions, let me add another feature to this dark story. You turn to see that the apprehended murderer sitting in the back of the police car is your daughter. Not some no-name freak, but your very own daughter, whom you love with every ounce of your being, just as you do your son. She's the one who killed your son. Now, how do you feel? Have your emotions changed? Become more conflicted? Are the justice issues as easy now? What form does your goodness and love take now? Suddenly you want justice for the murdered child and mercy for the guilty child. God is in just this type of predicament on a universal scale. Each and every human being is known and loved by God with the intimacy of a parent for their child. Yet each and every one of us has misused our freedom. Each and every one of us has caused pain. The line between good and evil runs through the middle of us, and so for God it's messy. If he puts an end to evil, he would have to put an end to us. Why would God take the risk? The answer is because he wants to achieve the best possible world. You see, we're not living in the best possible world. The best possible world is a world of absolute freedom and universal love. We have only one of the two. However, this world is the best way to the best possible world. As we, each and every one of us, see what horrible results occur from the misuse of our freedom, by God's grace, we learn to use our freedom to further the cause of love. From the Christian perspective, God has sought to achieve the best possible world through the work of Jesus Christ. On the cross, Jesus took upon himself the problem of evil. As an act of judgment, God eliminated evil in the person of Jesus Christ through his death. Because Jesus always used his freedom for love, he was resurrected. By trusting in God as he's revealed himself in Jesus, we find forgiveness for the misuse of our freedom. We find comfort in the midst of evil, and we are motivated to follow the example of Jesus to use our freedom to promote universal love and acceptance.
This message was produced by Arise, an evangelism, discipleship, and training ministry. To stay up to date on the latest media, news, events, and to learn more about how you can become a ministry partner, visit us online at arisehub.org.